So, then, I think we're about to start. So welcome to the third official session on social computing, social gaming. Last time there was a request by one of your fellow students who's in the other lecture hall listening to Wolfgang's talk if we could start 50 minutes past 3 o'clock. So who would be against starting 15 minutes past 3 o'clock? Okay, nice. So that's declined then, and we'll start on time for the rest of the lecture. Okay, so one word before I forget it. Tomorrow we'll be having another introduction of an assignment, right? So for the social computing students, that will not be interesting. For the social gaming students, it will be very much so, right? So please tell your colleagues that tomorrow we'll be introducing the second assignment. Good. So we left off with the final few slides on social games. And remember, still the story is we wanted to have a look at social games and games and definitions of games to, well, make the point in the end that we will treat this on equal footing to more general social media. Okay, so the rest of today's lecture will be devoted to looking at social media and various views and classification systems in the realm of social media. Okay, and then in the upcoming lectures, we'll be starting with social network analysis. Okay, good. So last time, as I said, we talked about most of the time talked about social games, and we left off with this discussion on various sorts or categories for fun as a primal motivation factor for playing games. Okay, now from the socio-psychological domain and seen from the perspective of socio-psychologists, there is, of course, a lot of studies on the social aspects of playing. And there is, instead of having a overall theory about this out there, it's more about some specific phenomena, right? One such specific phenomenon that plays an important role in terms of social games and social playing is so-called emotional contagion. And there's a lot of stories about that. So as you might have already read, it signifies the tendency to mimic other people's expressions, vocalizations, postures, movements, and also synchronize your own movements with that in case where you don't mimic that. Okay? So, in a sense, we have something that we might also call emotional convergence, right? So it's like if all the people are happy, you also have the tendency to also be happy. Okay, and that's interesting when you design games and social applications, because you have to have that in mind, that there is a group amplification process going on in the background. And that goes under the name of emotional contagion. That's especially relevant when you investigate, well, sexual attraction. Okay, if, let's say, typically men and women, if they find each other attractive, then they have a tendency to mimic each other's behavior, right? So if people touch their hair, if one touches her hair or his hair, the other person also starts fumbling around in the hair. Thank you for that contribution. We might, do you want to meet later on? No, thank you. Good. And other things as well, right? So mimicry is a way to express social bonding, right? And that's a built-in feature of Homo sapiens, right? And of course, the other effect you might also have read already, if other people are with you, this strongly affects your performance. Okay? So if you ever come in a situation where you're in a large lecture hall and several hundred students are staring at you and one is asking, on slide 45, shouldn't that read double integral sine instead of cosine? And what if I, in the complex space of fiber bundle homomorphisms, could you please comment on this? And then you, inside of your brain, there's an inner sweating taking place. Yeah. And that's not very pleasant, right? And you somehow have to talk yourself out of this. Okay. So this also has a name. It's called, Hawthorne effect, for those that want to read about this. There's a change in behavior if people just know that they're being watched. Okay. Good. One thing that's also interesting and that's pointed to by this ludologist is that, learning is a lot about, yeah, observing others and doing it in the same fashion, right? That's also interesting if you want to, let's say, have a tutorial for your social medium or a tutorial for your game. So this is something you can make use of there. And something that we have already seen is that, as it's quoted here, most gameplay exists within a social context, may it be explicit or implicit, right? So may it be in the game motives or may it really be in the multiplayer behavior. Okay, good. So that was what we had to say about the socio-psychological view on games. And this is an upcoming thing, right? So since games are becoming a major industry, there is a lot more socio-psychological research going on. And in future versions, we might include that into the lecture. So another point of view is to really sociologically investigate the communities and the social networks in digital games, right? And this is something which we'll do in the lecture. And there has been a third task in the Gamers Lab course in the previous years where we tried to employ social network analysis methods to detect gold farmers. That's an example I might have mentioned with the Chinese guys that earn their money by selling magic swords, right? But there's more to that, okay? So this is all embedded in a comparatively long history of social network analysis and community-oriented research. So at our chair, there were people even in the mid to late 1990s doing research on communities. And if you ask yourself, damn, why didn't they get rich? Why was it Mark Zuckerberg? I have no idea, right? I started 2001, years before Mark Zuckerberg became rich, and it's a pity. Yeah, I still have to work. Damn. So, what is obviously a, straightforward example of communities in digital games is massively multiplayer online games or role-playing games, the overmentioned World of Warcraft. There's a lot of research on that. What's interesting is that with all of social games and social media, there's a large body of data that is available now that can be subject to research, right? Alex Pentland, which is a very influential social computing researcher from MIT Media Lab, he wrote a book, and this book is called Honest Signals, right? And it's about social signal processing and the way large data sets kind of tend to tell the truth about people, right? Because there is a crowdsourcing effect in there. If one person can cheat, then 1,000 persons on average won't cheat in their behavior because that's a statistical effect. They just show what they're really like on average, right? And then there is a second thing that if you really take the data while people are interacting with the respective system, then this is also their honest behavior. This is in contrast to making surveys, for example. If you do a psychological survey, you're always in a lab setting. And this influences the way people think and behave. So it's interesting to raise the big data sets while people are interacting with social media and social games. Okay. And there's also another story that relates the social structures in the game to social structures outside. And this correspondence, large correspondence, can also be taken as a motivation to, well, just study general social network analysis and then work with analogy, a type of reasoning. Okay. How can you do that? Okay. So, four groups of methods that are distinguished in that study. So first of all, you can use all the arsenal of qualitative methods, such as they are used, for example, in information systems or economy, like focus group studies, where you would let people interact with your system, watch them, videotape them, record the audio, carefully transcribe it, and then analyze things on this qualitative level. Yeah. So the reasoning will always be, participants 2, 7, and 14 stated that, and then you cite, and then you draw conclusions from that. So it's rather lengthy texts that use statements, observations from these qualitative settings. Okay. What can also be used is interviews of all kind. May it be interviews with the participants, or may it be interviews with experts. Yeah. For example, games or social media experts. Okay. That's basically that. Okay. What you can then also use is classical surveys, right? So with the surveys, you will have to think, basically make a decision about the N you want, because you would typically use statistical tests to verify, for example, whether two numbers that are raised are different, right? T-test, for example, is a simple statistical test that you use in surveys, okay? Then the whole thing with data analytics, right? So this is, goes also under the paradigm of big data if you have enough of these, right? It's like you collect a data set via crawling, or whether you are the person that just runs the respective server, so you have all the access to it. And then you would use data mining or machine learning techniques. For example, a typical machine learning or data mining technique would be clustering. If you have, let's say, 5,000 players, you might want to find out, in which classes can you partition them, either in terms of marketing that you want to do, or in terms of, designing further versions of your game or your application whatsoever. And the last thing, which has, of course, its overlaps with the others, is social network analysis. You could, for example, also come up with clusters in social networks. And that would be different from the clustering techniques that you use in the data analytics domain. In the data analytics domain, you would typically use probabilistic clustering algorithms, while in the social network domain, you would use graph clustering, which is, of course, related, but slightly different, as we will see. Okay. Other things that work out here are, for example, to determine which actors in a network are central, which ones are important, through which actors runs most of the communication, right? Because these, again, are central figures in your social media or social game application. Okay. Now, of course, these groupings, for example, exist on various levels of abstraction or various size levels. So this goes from the macro level, where we would ultimately head for a whole gaming or social media subculture. So this goes in the tens of thousands or even millions of people that use a certain game, which is like a man goes to the meso level where you have guilds and the several thousands, and then to the micro level where you're in the realm of sociological small group research, right? And small group research is a subset of sociology or a subfield of sociology, which is guided by your perception, right? So obviously you're part of an overlapping set of groups, right? But the groups that we talk about here are small groups in that sense, because these are the groups that you can just perceive, right? So if I'm, let's say, member of the Social Democrat Party, this can be viewed as a group, of course, but the Social Democrat Party has like a million members, I don't know, or several million. But you just cannot perceive them socially. What you can perceive is, for example, your semester as a grouping. And this is already at the boundary. So in your semester, depends on which semester you're in, there are about, let's say, 100 persons. But you typically don't know all of them. So they're not in your ultimate or in your intimate perception range. So there is numbers that state that everything below 30 is something which you can perceive and feel as a group, right? And this is a small group. So these are typical numbers for the micro level, which then goes down to even binary interpersonal relationships and their properties. Okay? Good. And so what can you study? Okay, so there is studies on mechanisms of self-organization, right? So for example, the temporal scope of the groupings. So you might have a group in your lab course, but is this really a long-running group, or is this rather a medium-running group? What does it mean for your life? And there's a lot of studies in there. So for example, with respect to how the group is socially structured, there is a lot of work on, for example, leadership. Who is the leader? How many leaders are there? Who is the one that sets the tone in the group, and so on? Then, yeah, culture in the groups. That's an important thing for social media and games. And, of course, the spectrum of applications that these people in that group typically use to support the processes that go on in that group. Okay, good. Other things like learning in serious games, misbehaving studies, link prediction. Yeah, this is a typical thing in social computing. You want to predict how likely it is for a certain pair of persons that they might be related or would like to be related. So the corresponding service is typically called matchmaking or friend recommendation, something that you all might know from Facebook, right? And you always ask yourself, at least I do, what does Facebook think when it suggests me weird persons that I've never in my life would take into consideration. And it's somehow scary how good these algorithms are in guessing who am I really related with, and not just established the corresponding friendships. Communities we already mentioned, and also, technological aspects. So for example, if you have a certain latency in the communication, how does that affect group building and sociopsychological phenomena at the micro level? Good. So last but not least, there is a paper which suggested, in a descriptive framework, what are the key aspects of social play? And there are three such 3D diagrams. First one on the left looks at the spatio-temporal context of social play, which we will get to in a second. So here we distinguish time, whether something is persistent, so an ongoing game or an ongoing social app, or whether this is transient in the sense that it happens once and then is over. In terms of the space, we might distinguish no space games, such as chess, for example, or things that are merely on the communicative level, tending towards extended spaces like a 3D shooter in the extreme range. So this is the spatial axis. And there is another axis which kind of differentiates between the boundaries between the virtual game or virtual social medium and the real life part of it, right? And this ranges from purely real life environments, which have almost no or very small virtual components supporting them, ranging over augmented reality, augmented virtuality, and then purely virtual environments. Next one is about interaction, of course. Now, this is pretty clear. So is the interaction merely between the player and the world, which is more or less non-social, ranging towards the player interacting with other players, and something in between, is when players interact with non-player characters or intelligent objects. Okay, so this goes in the realms of, would that non-player character really pass the Turing test or not? Okay, the interaction can be passive or active, and the respective communication can range from asynchronous to synchronous, right? So asynchronous here states whether the expected reaction time is rather long, as in asynchronous, whereas in synchronous would be more in the realm of chatting and something like that, okay? And the last one here is about, well, as you can read, number of players from single to massively multiplayer. Here, the motivational axis, yeah, we've talked about this. Is your motivation extrinsic or intrinsic to use the specific app? And this one is another, debatable axis. Is the what about the seamlessness of the supporting technology, right? So a seamless technology would be a technology that is naturally cross-platform, for example, right? So the game world exists however you access it, via your smartphone, your tablet, whatever. It's like a seamless interaction also, right? If you have augmented reality components that mediate between the real and the virtual world, this will also contribute to seamlessness. Now, these are all the things that are noted here, right? So just for your reference, so things that I just told on these three slides. Well, and that's basically it, okay? So to sum that up, first thing, well, I've mentioned this, but I'll mention it again. We will not have this slide set in the exam. And that's for pragmatic reasons, because people refused to say, said it wouldn't be very comfortable to just learn everything, all the definitions and all these things. So my advice for interacting with this slide set, as I've said, is just think about this, make up your own conceptions and be critical, right? It's not set in stone, and just try to use that as an inspiration, for example, to find your own definition for game or your own matrix of how meta types and types are related, right? And there are a lot of links in there to interesting studies for those that want to dig deeper. So the background reading is Henry's master thesis, which again has a lot of citations to original sources. Okay, so that's that slide set on social games. Okay, now we will then move on to social media, right? Good. So, and the first part will be about social media in general. So what are possible definitions? What are characteristics of social media? And especially, what do I understand by social context? And at the end, we will then dig deeper into social networking, social networking specifics and then switch towards social network analysis. So first part here is about definitions of social media. Okay. So every one of you probably has an intuition what social media is and or what it is not. But if you try to pin that down, it's not so easy as in games and play to come up to really come up with a consistent definition. Okay. So slides like this are a standard part of every talk about social computing and social media, right? So tag clouds on the right, so a lot of terms that appear there, right? Concrete things like Foursquare, Facebook, but categories like blogging, other things that are necessary like networks, may it be social or physical networks, whatever. And a lot of these nice pastel colored icons that, well, try to set up themselves against others. Okay. Twitter, Facebook, whatever. Good. So, Tim O'Reilly, which is one of the earlier protagonists of that kind of acted in that space, came up with a definition of Web 2.0. Yes? No. Slides are not online. But there, the stuff from last year is online, which is pretty simple, pretty similar, right? So in a sense they are. And one thing that I might have forgotten to tell you that the Fachschaft has printed my last year's slides as a script, right? So you can buy them if you want. So because some of the students last year, they uttered the wish for having the slides in advance so they can make notes. And that's pretty much the best solution. Buy the script and you'll have it. Okay. Now, Tim O'Reilly, that's his definition for Web 2.0. And one word of caution. So these days, people are talking a lot about Industry 4.0 or the Web 5.0 and bus driving 8.0. And this is frowned upon, right? So everybody that knows his or her business will frown upon things such as 3.0 or 5.0 because that's arbitrary. And I once had a colleague in a project that was very fit in designing all those terms, and his talks and slides were full of these numbers, right? And he had a very fine-grained way of distinguishing between that, but that's pure nonsense, okay? So giving version numbers to the web. Okay, good. However, you know the term Web 2.0, and, well, that's the definition. You have already read it, right? So obviously he views it as a business revolution. Internet as a platform is a characterizing paradigm. And what he emphasizes is that applications are built that use network effects, generate them, harness them, use them to improve people's utility. And what he also emphasizes is this phenomenon of harnessing collective intelligence, right? So people are becoming prosumers. They publish, they consume at the same time. Private persons also publish content. People participate in the web. So that's why Web 2.0 is the web of participation. And as we see in red, we need the network effects to really improve or maximize utility. Okay, you still don't agree? Okay, good. So what about that paradigm switch? Okay, so we have to look at these things in turn. So what does he understand by the web as a platform? So it's more like a slogan, but it already points to things like thin clients, software that runs as a web application, a rich web application, and also points to the web as a networked system, which acts as a platform for the applications. Okay, so this points to replacing this static monolithic software that people might have installed on their systems or still install on their systems by networked web services. So that already points to another aspect of web as a platform, namely web services. So a service in the sense of a service-oriented architecture service is a piece of IT system, so software and hardware, that fulfills a distinct role and provides a distinct small service that has its clearly defined interfaces and boundaries. And if you want to set up a software, you would compose it out of web services. So a typical example would be geo web services. Okay. So if you want to include geolocations into your applications, what you typically need is a service that kind of deals with your GPS location, encode that according to your ellipsoid where you are, whatever. Then something that deals with maps, something that deals with physical aspects of maps, and something that deals with traffic infrastructure on maps. So layered architectures where each layer is provided by a certain web service. And web services, as you know them, are pretty narrowly defined in terms of the protocols that they use, for example, SOAP or UDDI and these things. And this is still largely a part of this, but, well, not every aspect of web as a platform uses web services. So the typical rich web application using JavaScript on the client side and a rather intelligent server and some AJAX JSON communication would go by that as well. Second thing, harness collective intelligence. This is something that you also might know, things that have to do with wisdom of the crowd in the largest sense, right? And this is also a phenomenon that we have to really closely investigate, because wisdom of the crowd can also turn into stupidity of the crowd, right? Sometimes it's better to stick out in a certain sense and to emphasize these special tendencies instead of just to measure an average, for example, opinion, okay? What's also characteristic is that data is becoming increasingly important. So these days, it's not about the processing power that someone has, it's about the data that the respective company controls, right? So if you look at all the big companies, Facebook, Google, and all of them, their main business model is based on data that they have that other companies don't, right? So these days, even in science, it's not about the analytic methods, it's about the data sets that you have. And again, going back to Alex Pentland, he once gave a talk at a conference that I was, and then he listed the kind of data sets that he had. And one thing was, for example, he had a data set of several years of credit card transactions in the U.S., and not just several of them, all of them, yes? And that's nice data set. I mean, you can use it to draw conclusions about behavior, human behavior on all scales. I don't know how he got it. Maybe I got this wrong, but I think I remember that he had these data, okay? He raised other data sets. For example, in his fund project, he equipped about several hundred users with smartphones and custom software that he and his PhD students wrote. And those people were surveyed 24/7 in their community behavior, right? So audio sensing, proximity sensing, geolocation sensing, in-room location and all of that, right? The data set and the studies didn't work out quite as spectacular, I think, as they had wished, but still, it's a huge data set, and well, it needs a lot of money, right? So buy 100 smartphones if you're just a PhD student here. It's not so easy, right? So it's about the data. The services are continuously updated, which is a consequence of this web as a platform, thin clients and so on, lightweight programming models, which is also a consequence here, software above the level of a single device already points towards cross-platform user experience. And for the game students, I gave you links to David Banyan's book, which are also accessible to the social computing students. It's a very nice book that explains the difference between human-computer interaction that just focuses on the UI and designing user experience, which is something slightly different, right? So one thing is that you can access pretty anything via any device you want, right? Providing a rich user experience, which is kind of a consequence or a prerequisite, which is however closely related to that. Okay. Good. So, well, this is again, it appears to be a bit fuzzy, but, well, that's the way you have to deal with things in that, on that level of abstraction. Okay. So what is Web 2? Well, denoting the extension of the classical web in terms of social media services and social media platforms. So what is a social media service then? It is obviously web-based, okay? It supports social interaction between people, may it be directly or indirectly, especially communication. And how does it do so? So large amounts of content are created and exchanged by a broad user base, a user base that consists not only of IT specialists. Okay. So that is where the broad user base comes in. And that's a really important thing. And a social media platform could then be defined as a functionally coherent bundle of such social media services, yeah, where it's not often totally clear whether something is just a single service or a platform. So for Facebook, it's rather clear. Facebook is made up as a bundle of distinct services, whereas Foursquare, for example, although it has certain platform extensions, is basically about checking in at locations, bang. And so, well, you can discuss whether Foursquare is a platform or a service in that sense. And, well, what is also necessary for that platform is that we have a bundle of network technologies which is commonly accessible. So something that is not as publicly accessible as Facebook cannot really justifiably be called a platform. Okay? Good. Well, obviously, things you can be as fine-grained as you like, right? So you can distinguish a social media service or a social media platform on the one hand from its instance, okay? So, for example, if we look at a social networking or community software that can be used to build up such platforms, for example, Elk, right? The Elk is a PHP-based software which you can use to set up your own Facebook if you like. So in a sense, you might call this a social media platform. However, what's really important is that the technological aspects are not what you really need. So what you need is an instance of the technology plus a user base, a concrete user base. So Facebook in that sense could or should be called a social media platform instance in a way. Often these companies make their own custom platform because Facebook doesn't sell its implementation to other social networks. So the platform and the instance are the same in that case. This might be different for others. Well, then we might distinguish certain service classes, okay, which we will do so in a few minutes. Then there is social media service software. that implements such services. So, for example, Wikipedia, with its true user base of authors, is a social media platform instance, but it uses MediaWiki as a software platform to implement that. Right? So this is more or less technical, but in a sense, I would advertise in distinguishing these things. And the same goes with platform software, as I mentioned, the ELK software implementing social networking platforms. Okay. And by the term social software, we mean the union of social media service software and platform software, if you like. Now, of course, these definitions, again, are not set in stone, and there's issues with these definitions. So first issue is with limitations or delimiters, right? So where does social software end, and where do other classical fields of computer science begin? For example, CSCW, computer-supported cooperative work, right? This is a classical field in computer science. And the question now is social software or social media, is that a superset or just an overlapping set with CSCW? So I would advertise being rather liberal. And with a liberal view, social CSCW is social media, because the form of social interaction that's supported in this case is just collaboration. So you collaboratively design software, or you collaboratively codify knowledge of some sort. Okay, so Google Docs, for example, can be considered social software in that sense, although it's not like this Facebooky, fluffy, colorful, easygoing, spare time oriented things. So Google Docs might really be used in a professional setting, right? The same is true for things such as creativity support systems. I mentioned that in the lecture on assignment number one for the games engineering students. So systems on tabletops or web-based, which can be used to implement creativity techniques, such as six-hat thinking method or brainstorming or others. Okay. On the one hand, they are professionally oriented tools, but on the other hand, they fulfill all the criteria of social media, yeah, because, well, as we just defined, if you go through these, you will see that. So that's one issue. And the traditional view would be that CSCW is not actually social media. Yeah. So people have the tendency to distinguish both. But as I said, if you want to take a liberal view, I would say it's perfectly fine if you include that. Okay. One other delimiting thing is that people normally say that social media or social software is about user-generated content that's created outside of professional routines and practices. Okay? Now, everything where people earn money is not truly social media. But that's really not true these days. So there are professional YouTubers. There's a lot of people that make their money with social media on the one hand. And on the other hand, there is companies using social media techniques. For example, in terms of knowledge management, right? In the early 2000s, when we had the Munich Knowledge Management Circle, people had really huge solutions in companies to codify knowledge, right? So there is still aspects of that left over, for example, in terms of, modeling of business processes, like ARIS and other formats that are used to model business processes. But other knowledge management activities like project debriefings and so on, they all had their tools and their practices and so on. Nowadays, companies just use wikis for that, or they use even project blogs or so, right? So all these social software and social media ideas have moved into the professional realm as well. So this increasingly becomes blurred, okay? Well, another definition issue. So in this OECD definition of social media, it says that the user-generated content should show a certain amount of creative effort, right? Now the question is, well, does that make WhatsApp a non-social media application or service, right? Well, 99% of the stuff that's communicated or created as content on WhatsApp is total trash, right? From a creative aspect. I mean, set aside the few jokes that are really funny, but most of the stuff is rather, yes, when will you come? Ah, yeah, in a second. Yeah, okay, blah, blah, fazzle. Okay. So for that, do we then have to exclude everything that's just communication oriented? I would say no, right? Because Skype and WhatsApp and all these things can really be considered social media, right? Although the content in most cases does not really show this hate of creative, niveau, right? Good. Other issues. There are critics that's even more radical critics in terms of this version numbering that says, go die with your web 2. There is no such thing as a web 2.0. There's just the web. And it's a continuously evolving technological system with all its JavaScript, JSON, and other technologies and usage pragmatics. So the web from the beginning has had all the characteristics that we subsumed under Web 2, because it has been a decentralized system where everybody could participate in generating a page, for example, right? However, well, if you take that seriously, there is no such thing as Web 2.0, okay? Because even in 1995, everybody could have a web server, could upload an HTML 1.0 page with links and some images, bang, and you had the content. But it's, again, I wouldn't be so strict, because it's about the, well, it's about how easy it is to publish content. And in that times, it wasn't easy at all, right? So you had a lot to do before you had a homepage online, okay? Nowadays, it's much easier to post something. So it's about the respective hurdles that you have to take. So yes, technologically, Web 2.0 was structurally designed to be a decentralized networked medium, but the degrees of collaboration, social interaction, and distributed content generation and exchange weren't yet there. You have to say that. Okay. However, if you want to dig into that, only history research will tell whether there was a real, there was real reason to call this step or transition to Web 2 something as a step, right? Good. Again, relating to that, what we had on the previous slide, there is a lot of stories that lead the debate on the quality of user-generated content. So from a political science perspective, it's very interesting in terms of how decision and information processes in our society change if the content is not editorial from journalists, qualified journalists, such as in the 1960s, compared to the situation of today where every idiot can post something on the web. And if a lot of idiots post a lot of idiotic stuff, then this can lead to processes that we might not really want, right? So there is any obscure theory can be put on the web, right? So 9/11, it was the Americans that shot down the Twin Towers, blah, 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 blah. You can see that. And then there's several YouTube films that show the collapse looks like an explosion, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. So the web is full of nonsense. And the one question is, can we filter it out? Yeah. What if we devise services that filter out nonsense, wouldn't these be in turn also in danger of becoming censorship, right? So these seemingly democratic processes also clearly have their pros and cons. And that's interesting to really assess the quality of the user-generated content. Now, once again, let's become slightly more concrete. What are social media characteristics? Okay. And again, there is a lot of researchers that come up with certain characteristics. One thing, low technical barriers. As I said, that's maybe the real step from web one to web two. Constantly changing content, which is interactive, meaning that you have back channels on a discussion board or something, you can read the answers of others immediately. And it's about dynamics as well, right? So Twitter, for example, is a fast medium. And in conferences like ICWSM, there are a lot of papers that make use of this dynamic pace, okay? So if you take the Fukushima case where people were able to more quickly post radiation levels on the web compared to the official bodies like whatever the government, you could really see these effects of dynamic content generation. It's the same phenomenon can be found, for example, in other things like these 2007 wildfires in California where, well, asynchronous help was organized way quicker than the government bodies would have been able to, right? And that's a tragedy with Nepal, because obviously the infrastructure is not that developed, so people don't have enough chances to set this up. And even more so, if you really have an earthquake or a major disaster, there is no such thing as a wireless network anymore, yeah, because everything collapses, right? So, however, in the Southern California case, where the infrastructure was still largely there, people were able to quickly set up, grassroots movements, yeah. Other things that have been largely investigated is this Arab Spring phenomenon, and there is an ongoing debate what role the social media have played in that as a medium, obviously, and what role they have not played, right? So this is more sociological things, yeah? So Christina Lerman came up with this definition, which is now already several years old. She emphasized the social information processing paradigm we've talked about, and in her 2007 talk, she came up with these classification axes or bins, yeah? So authoring tools, collaboration tools, tagging systems, social networking, collaborative filtering, and social games. And surprisingly so, in 2007, social games were already a separate category. We'll be having a different set, a classification set that I'll introduce to you in a few minutes. What's really important, or what's a really important characteristic that I want to emphasize, because that'll carry through all of the lectures, is that social media is about explicating, making explicit relations, or to model relations. And there are several relations, several classes of relations. So first of all, we have users and the items that they generate, or the items that are out there. And these can be generated items such as a blog post, but these can also be things as buildings and their model representations on Foursquare, for example, right? User to item relations are very manifold, right? So one important user item relation model is tagging. Yeah. Because as I explained to you in one of the hours that have already passed, is that tags are triples made up by person, item, and the actual string, the actual tag itself. Okay. Another user item relation could be a rating, which is very important. So that's user item relations. Then there is item to item relations. Again, via tagging. For example, the items that share the same tags or share a large amount of similar tags. Yeah. Taxonomies are a model of item to item relations. Okay. Taxonomies were systems of tag triples that are further analyzed. For example, further clustered or made subject to word sense disambiguation or made subject to synonym detection and stuff like that. Okay. And last category that's mentioned here is semantic metadata. Yeah. Which gives rise to the so-called semantic web, right? Who has heard of semantic web? Hands up. Who has never heard of semantic web? Okay, good. So we'll be having this in, next time, I think. Good. Now, you already have guessed that user-to-user relations are very important. And that's what I would subsume under social context, right? So social context for the moment is models of any aspect of social interaction that has a relation to an IT system. Yeah. So social interaction aspects that have nothing to do with IT systems or that have just no bearing in them, with them, about them are not meant by this. Yeah. So for example, I like another person, and that's just a one-way thing, right? This is nowhere represented in no blog post, in no behavior of mine. It's just something that's in my thoughts, right? It is certainly an aspect of the social relation to that person, but it's not related to any IT system, right? A Facebook friendship that I have is a simple model of a long-term social relation that is represented in a social networking platform, namely Facebook. And then you can ask, what does it mean, right? Is it an intense friendship? Is it a kinship? Is it something that has to do with friendship only or with competition, whatever, right? So what you do is to have any aspect of social interaction and you model it. And in order to model it, you have to be able to also detect these modeled aspects, right? One way of detecting is just asking the user. And that's what Facebook does with its friendships, right? So you explicitly state that you have a friendship, right? Other things are social co-presence that you might, for example, detect via analyzing audio or via analyzing interaction geometry. How close am I to other people? Are we standing in a grouping or is it just by chance in the subway? Okay. Obviously, besides those characterizing elements, there's a whole stack of social media technologies. Okay. And well, it's everything that enables rich web application. Web applications is also used in social media. Yeah? So ranges from basic web protocols such as HTTP or HTTPS to languages for the declarative representation of structure, content, and format, right? And for example, HTML and HTML5 are languages that encompassingly represent structure, content, and format at the same time. So there are tags even, yeah, let's say in HTML4, like the bold tag, for example, that's clearly a format tag, whereas body and head are structuring tags. And then there is also, other tags that, or other content between the tags that kind of provides the content. Whereas other XML-related languages, for example, the whole XML technology stack is geared towards separating structure definitions from content from format. And this format thing is also present in the HTML world, of course, with CSS and all the other format-oriented languages. But XML really pulls that through, right? Just to really have a separate XML language for each of these aspects. For example, XSLT to transform one structure into another, or even specialized XML languages like geographic markup language, right? This is a way to, come up with a language for specific fields. If you want to take that one step further, then you'll arrive at the languages of the semantic web. So, for example, as RDF, RDFS, OWL, or query languages like Sparkle, which would allow you to set up, maintain, and use general ontologies. Now, ontologies are shared conceptualizations. For example, in geographic markup language, you have something like a location, which could be like a longitudinal, latitudinal, two-number coordinate in a spherical coordinate system. Yeah. But what is a location? A location is a concept. Yeah. So what do I mean with I'm here? Do I mean here precisely, or do I mean in that lecture hall, or do I mean at the campus? Yeah. What do I mean? Do I mean am I here at the bottom, or is the height also important? So these are ontological specifications, and in an ontology, you will distinguish concepts. So, for example, a general ontology might have concepts such as car, human, table, all these things. And these are related to other concepts in a taxonomical way. For example, a human is a subconcept of mammal, and mammal is a subconcept of animal, and animal a subconcept of living thing, right? And semantic web languages allow you to, be free with these ontologies. So while in specialized XML languages, you have a set of predefined tags, but the semantics of these tags have to be made clear in a separate standardized document, right? So for GML, there's a large document where it says location means this and this and this, and you're free, if you say long lat value, you're free to insert like a 7-digit natural number that describes the latitude of your location, blah, blah, blah. Has to be made clear in text. Whereas in semantic web, you can explicitly define such contexts as concepts and reason about them in certain limited ways. Yeah? Good. So that was, already in the conceptual logic direction. There is more concrete things, such as the whole stack of client-side technologies, JavaScript, JSON, AJAX, all these things, and deprecated things such as Flash or Silverlight that these days nobody uses. Sorry, Microsoft, but Silverlight, I mean, nobody uses it. Server side, you all know these things. Ruby, PHP, the whole Java family, Java server pages, server faces, J2EE, all these things. Yeah. And in the lab course, we'll be using lean Java technology and Android on server and client, so this is should be rather manageable. Syndication technologies, Atom, for example, and whole social software packages like Elk or Media Wiki, right? Good. Well, Christina Lerman, on the previous slide, just came up with, I think, 5 or 6 categories of social media. Now we will see whether we can be a bit more detailed in terms of social media classes. Okay. Now, first of all, There's other researchers, obviously, that already came up with social media classification systems. So one example is by Kaplan and Henlein from 2010. And they distinguish two axes, okay? So the y-axis in that schema is about the degree of self-presentation or self-disclosure that's present in the respective class of social media. And while the x-axis is about the degree of socialness and at the same time the degree of media richness. Okay, let's investigate the first column here, right? So if I'm rather low in social presence, if I'm in the realm of low self-presentation, I'm in the field of collaborative social media, like, for example, Wikipedia. In Wikipedia, the authors are not really visible. They're only visible if you look at the discussion pages of the respective articles, right? But there's no such thing as this was authored by Horst Schmidt, right? So low degree of self-presentation. In contrast to classical blogs or microblogs, where obviously self-presentation is an important thing, right? And here, Medium, you have all these things such as social networking, Facebook. I post whatever, my activities, my food, my blah, my blub, right? I don't know why people do that, but they do it. And with low self-presentation, you have stuff like YouTube, yeah, where the content counts. And in Facebook, it's more important who posts things, right? And here in that category of high social presence, high media richness, you have these virtual life simulation frameworks such as Second Life. And obviously there is self-presentation, self-disclosure is high, whereas in virtual game worlds, it's again more about the game. While still being very social, the original social nature of the player is disguised by his or her avatar. Then there is this second classification system, which is about several aspects of the respective classes, right? If we start at the top and proceed clockwise, we start with presence, right? So this is about awareness services, where are others? Then relationship as an important class, reputation, where it's about standing and reputation, groups, communities, groupings, whole subnetworks, conversations, and sharing. These are all aspects where you might classify a given social medium according to these things in turn. And identity is just written in the middle because it's convenient graphically, but it's just another aspect, right? The extent to which users reveal themselves. So this sets up a system of axes along which you can classify social medium and given social medium. And this is the line of thinking that we will follow, defining certain axes, which we can then use to classify our given social media platform or service. Now, one thing that's a very important aspect of each form of social medium is communication. Okay? So you might put everything that goes under the concept of social media under the paradigm of supporting communication in one form or the other. So it's a good idea to look at access systems that allow us to distinguish various forms of communication, naturally, right? And, social media typically support certain types of communication, but let's look at the axes that we can use, right? So first of all, we have to distinguish the cardinality of the communication. Is it typically one-to-one, one-to-n, or n-to-m? right? Just as in entity relationship diagrams. Okay? Then we might distinguish whether the communication is directed or indirect. And there are mixture forms of that, right? So if I'm Justin Bieber and I have 100,000 followers on Twitter, this is a typical form of indirect communication. So if he tweets something, he just doesn't know all of his recipients. If I'm myself, I don't have a Twitter account, if I correctly remember. Let's assume I had one and I had 3 followers. Yeah, then it might also be viewed as a form of directed communication, one to N, albeit, but directed because I know them, right? So direct versus indirect is about, is it specifically targeted towards a known audience, or is it so indirect that you don't even know the recipient set? Anonymity, is it anonymous or non-anonymous? That's clear. Is the identity of the sender known or is it unknown? On the web, nobody knows you're a dog. That's a very early saying from the early 1990s by the former director of the MIT Media Lab. Nowadays, a bit strange. Threatedness, are we talking about communication that goes in threats, so with post reply, post reply, post reply, or is it typically just a one-shot thing? Depends. Okay. Then continued. What about the content? Is it textual? Is it graphical? Is it video? Or is it contextual? So by contextual, I mean or I understand content forms which communicate context elements, such as locations. So Foursquare would typically be about communicating location context. Yeah. And again, we have to distinguish, is it the true content or is it contextual content kind of augmenting some other type of content? Yeah. And there's no real division between what is truly input data, important, relevant data for a service, or just contextual, improving, utility improving context data. Yeah. Then the transmission, is it stream or discrete user interface? Maybe is it mobile, laptop or desktop? Whatever is the case. And the goals, right? Are we talking about higher level goals? Such as being informed. I use Dig as a news service because I want to be informed. Or is it about lower levels of abstraction, whatever, exchange, yeah, movies, like put some MP3 file online for others to download. Yeah, depends. So this is more like, well, find a partner might also be included in higher level of abstraction. Depends. Okay, good. So, but MP3, exchanging MP3s is more like a more technical, more lower thing. Last axis about commercialization. Is it commercial or non-commercial? Right? Good. So these are access that you can use to classify the communication form prevalent in the respective social media. Now, other classification systems, so one might be to distinguish 3 core classes, again, of social media. And this is something that I find appealing just because of that, there's this slide, so first course class is awareness services. Yeah. So these services are about contextual content in most cases. So it's about informing users about events or states that are directly linked with other users and fulfill certain criteria. And this can be done proactively so that in a push-based way, inform about changes in context. Your friend has changed her location to blah, 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 or on request. Where is my friend? Okay. It's about contextual data. It's about contextual content, and the typical form is 1-to-N or even M-to-N. It's indirect, right? So you inform subscribers about the respective context. It's non-anonymous because, most context elements awareness services only make sense if I know who is, for example, at a certain location. So it can be of limited usefulness if I know, for example, if I go out on Saturdays in Munich and I just want to know which club is filled with people and which club is rather empty. Then I might also have a certain utility by just counting the number of users without revealing who it really is. So it might also make sense in an anonymous way, but mostly it's about non-anonymous things, right? And a subclass would be location-based awareness services. Yeah? Then there is direct communication. Okay. As the name says, it's all subsets of texting, messaging, direct communication in the true sense. Even email could be included there. And services that are more geared towards indirect communication, which go by the name of information services, right? Because information, spreading information is normally about indirect one-to-end communication, right? And the majority of the finer grained classes that we will now discuss go under these information services. Okay, good. So, once again, we had several class-oriented definitions, two by other authors, one by Christina Lerman, and then we said, okay, axes are important. For example, axes characterizing communication. And for the last 10 minutes, we might quickly take a look at some other classes of social media that you might or might not know, which we will very quickly go through. And again, the task would be take the slides and try to use the respective classification paradigms introduced before to check the respective class. So, for example, are blogs really about indirect communication? Are blogs typically one-to-N? Yeah, which they are, right? And so this is not intended to be a complete list or something that you would just have to listen to, but something to make up your mind about, right? Now, I distinguished several bins that are, again, overlapping and gave them these category names in red. And then there is a lot of these things going on that form the classes or subclasses. And as I said, for the last few minutes, let's look at some. Now, clearly, one typical subclass of class with an emphasis on communication is blogs, right? Everybody knows blogs, right? So there are classes that it overlaps with, clearly microblogs. And there's also a superclass, again here, class with an emphasis on certain forms of communication. You might also say it's about information, so let's call it a subclass of information. It's also a subclass of communication in a certain way, but this again is a matter of which aspects you want to emphasize. Okay, so it's about one-to-end communication, and typically in classical blogs, it's indirect. So I don't know all my recipients. It's non-anonymous, at least from the sender side. If you read a blog, you know by who it is. It's non-threaded, right? I constantly put out my blog posts, my diary. You can read it or not, or even slightly comment it, but there is no real thread structure in that. It's typically desktop or laptop, because at mobiles we're already talking about microblogs, that's Twitter and stuff. So the classical blogosphere is by people that almost editorially create content on their laptop. Discrete transfer, I post it and then it's gone. It's no thing as a scream, as a stream, and it's typically non-commercial, right? And associated with it are goals such as self-presentation. Remember the stuff with these six B structures that I had on this slide here, this one here, yeah, where we had various goals as an axis to classify this. And it's also about informing and, to a limited extent, also about awareness. Okay, and then you can continue this list, like microblogging. What's the difference between a blog and a microblog? It's in the length of the content and in the device and the situation that is used to generate it. So that's why in Twitter you have 144 characters per tweet, because it's the old SMS standard. Okay, and it's typically about your more fine-grained reporting of your situation instead of temporally and spatially more elongated periods that you talk about. So in blogs, you might talk about your week, while in tweets, you might talk about your last few minutes, if that is the case. However, that depends on the pragmatics, right? For example, the mentioned Justin Bieber might, if he really writes his tweets by himself and has not a team of professionals doing so, it's more, again, more in the weekly domain. Yeah, I put out adverts, my new base cap is now online on Amazon, please buy it, blah, 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 stuff like that. Okay, so there is a constant change in pragmatics going on. Now, also under this superclass of classes with an emphasis on certain forms of communication are wikis, right? Because in wikis, we typically have end-to-end communication. There's a lot of people editing it, and there's also a lot of people consuming it. It's typically anonymous, yeah, like, or at least semi-anonymous. So if you read a Wikipedia page, the author of a specific piece of text is not really fully highlighted, at least not in the usual mode. So you'd have to look it up in the history to find that out. Yeah? And typical goals are knowledge management, yeah, codification of knowledge. That's what it's used in professional realms as well as in non-professional. Then there is classical discussion boards, which are either a part of other platforms or which are, yeah, standalone discussion boards. So, for example, this is about martial arts and especially mixed martial arts. Then there is lots of others like Stack Overflow, which are more targeted towards nerdy technological things, right? And typically, well, depends. In Stack Overflow, it's not so much about communication, but it's much more a medium of informing yourself, right? And the boundaries between those two things are really subtle and they're really confluent, right? So what's more a thing that has more the character of information or more the character of communication is debatable, right? Again, the supported typical communication form is threaded, right? That's why discussion boards, what their characteristic is. And the goals are exchange opinions and facts, right? Messaging is something that I put in brackets, right? Because of that issue, whether we want to have something like Skype or WhatsApp as a real social medium, because it's more about one-to-one communication, and one-to-one is something binary, dyadic, and not something that is typically social, okay? However, if we have one-to-end communication, yeah, such as a WhatsApp list, yeah, that you post something to, it's clearly a social medium. If you have something that acts as a telephone conference platform, like a Skype conference call, it is a social medium, right? But yeah, take it with a grain of salt. Same is true with more specific messaging systems, such as IP telephony, Skype, which is a subclass of this, right? And also with chat, right? Because in chat is more social, typically more social, because classical chat rooms, which are, I don't know if they're at all popular these days, they're a typical end-to-end communication form. But chat elements are also used in other platforms. For example, yeah, even in Facebook, chat-like communication can arise in these comment fields or in personal messaging with a very low latency time. Or you might have something like, I don't know, dating platform establishing one-to-one chats with other persons. I don't know. Yeah. But again, usually not considered social medium. In the M2N case, we might be inclined to subsume it there. Social games, something we talked about extensively, obviously a social media class. Okay. Now, is SVN or GitHub social medium? That's, if you consider it a social medium, it's a rather exotic social medium. And normally people wouldn't subsume it under that category. However, as we already said, if collaboration is a form of social interaction, then it clearly is a social medium, right? People check in, there is diffs, there is conflicts that have to be resolved, there is awareness in that. So your collaborator just checked in a new software version, blah, 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 of that class. So it retains a lot of these characteristics. So once again, make up your mind in how far revision control or code tools are really considered social media. Same is true for classical content management, right? So wikis are a form of content management in a sense, yeah? Wikipedia actually is. And that's a classical social medium. But would you also consider something like Typo3 or WordPress as a social medium? Typo3 is a classical content management system, which we, for example, use for the informatics faculty's website. Yeah. Well, there are a lot of people concurrently editing that website, and such it can be called a social endeavor, a social effort by all the faculty members. And I'm, for example, responsible for the master games engineering part of that. Well, it can be considered a social medium, right? Okay, so we can continue this list, and we will next time as a starting point. But the homework would be make up your mind. There is a list. I will put online the slides in a few minutes. There's a list of these things and try to establish the definitions of social medium to those classes and try to see whether what's on the slide fits your own intuition. Yeah, as the same with the games, okay? So tomorrow, no lecture, but instead assignment number 2 introduction. We'll be shortly introducing the technologies and the boundary conditions of that. And, well, so some of you, we might be, I say see you tomorrow, and for others, see you next week. Bye.